Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters, that's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. picoshouse.com/newsletters. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2 are only 99 cents for a limited time. The gods are rightfully imprisoned, and Cess intends to keep them that way. But her terrorist father has other plans. Gregory D. Little's Unwilling Souls is a pulse-pounding chase through an epic fantasy world of adventure, sinister conspiracy, and a magical industrial revolution fueled by harvested human souls. Cess is the daughter of powerful parents who would very much like to kill one another and who therefore pretend she doesn't exist. An apprentice jailer of the gods, Cess spends her days learning to forge the tools needed to maintain the gods' prison. When her terrorist father attacks the prison on her 16th birthday, Cess is forced to flee after the secret of her parentage is revealed. Suddenly on the wrong side of the law, Cess realizes the very father who abandoned her may be the only one who can protect her. But some secrets are darker than parentage. On her way to find her father, Cess will uncover truths about her family and herself that will shatter her understanding of the world and risk the return of the gods themselves. Unwilling Souls and its sequel, Ungrateful God, are on sale now for only 99 cents. The third book of the series is coming early next year, so now is the perfect time to get up to speed. Unwilling Souls by Gregory D. Little. Books 1 and 2, only 99 cents for a limited time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, joining me is one of my all-time favorite storytellers and a man that I believe still holds the record for the most appearances on Author Stories, and we're going to put one more notch in that belt today. My good friend Nick Cole joins me again today. Welcome back, Nick.
Oh, thank you, sir. It is good to be the Alec Baldwin of this podcast. just a steady performer who shows up no matter what, and you know, it's good to be out of jail finally.
As always, we expect some Baldwin moments on the show. Nick, when you first came on the show, like 100 years ago, we talked. Let's see, your new release at the time was Soda Pop Soldier, and we had talked a little bit about the Wasteland Saga and how you told us a little bit of the origin story of that and where the book came from. And I believe we even talked about you doing some licensing from Old Man of the Sea and how all of this came about and how indie publishing was this brand new, unplowed frontier. And the Wasteland Saga had found an audience and then got picked up by HarperCollins. And then I think we were mostly talking about Soda Pop Soldier, but there was this kind of origin story that we never really dug into deeply. Well, lo and behold, like almost six years later, the Old Man in the Wasteland has come back to you, and you have gotten to do with this series, with this book and the subsequent series, what you always wanted to do with it. What's it been like with this journey of this first book? You know, that first thing that we always write always has a special place in our heart, and I know that the Old Man in the Wasteland had that for you. Could you kind of recap for us where this book came from and what it is that makes this series so special to you?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's interesting. The Old Man and the Wasteland is literally a chronicle of the indie movement for me, because for me, the indie movement begins about 2011, and I'm the typical writer at that point. You know, maybe I had a Hollywood agent, maybe people didn't. I mean, a New York literary publishing agent. But I was working in Hollywood as an actor, and it's funny, I didn't even have a Hollywood agent, but I had a literary agent. I got a Hollywood agent later. But it's so odd for people to understand now when we talk about indie and Amazon, or, you know, sometimes I use the word new pub or whatever we're saying. Hybrid is a big word that came in vogue. But it's interesting when you say the word self-pub, like before 2011, you know, going back to like the 1970s, I think when self-pub kind of like first explodes, you think of like some real estate agent at the end of the bar who's going to sell you books out of the back of his trunk, you know, and like it had such a bad, nasty reputation. And I'm sitting there, you know, with this Hollywood book that I wrote, and I got a New York agent and no one's buying it. And I'm starting to hear about this Amazon thing. And so, long story short, I start learning about it from various blogs, and I put the book up. I offer it to my agent. My agent says, no, it's too much like Cormac McCarthy, and I can't even sell your first book. And what I had written is basically The Old Man in the Sea after a nuclear war, because I saw the parallels of survival and salvage and redemption and not being finished unless you decide you're finished, which are all themes in Hemingway's The Old Man in the Sea, you know, man versus nature, that kind of thing. And I just have always been fascinated by the post-apocalypse. And honestly, at the time, like the Fallout 3 video game was coming out, this is how long ago it was. And I didn't have any money because I was a broke actor. And I'm like, well, you know, I'll just write what I think it would be. And I started fooling around with it. I offered to my agent, like I said, he said no. So like I said, I'd been researching IndiePub. There was this thing called KDP. People were doing it. Guys like Joe Conrath were doing really well. I researched, I read, I prepared, I threw my hat in the market. I spent like maybe about $1,800 that I didn't have to publish it on a credit card, and told my wife, don't worry, this Joe Conrath guy's making like 68,000 bucks a month, you know, and everything like that. This is gonna work. And then like first month, two sales. And I remember my wife, who is just the most wonderful person, you know, just still like supporting me and everything like that. She was like, well, like, when does the 68,000 a month start? And I was like, well, you know, hang in there. The next month it was like eight sales. You know, we've all been there. But as defeating as that sounds, and we all know this, and you know that, Hank, because you're a real writer. You know that the coolest thing, even if it was two or eight sales, was that someone bought it. Like, now we're all used to, well, if I don't launch with 1,000 sales a day, blah, blah, blah. You know, we've lost our first love, as the Bible, you know, says. But back in 2011, you sold those two copies. You sold those eight copies. Those were people that you didn't met, wasn't your relatives, wasn't your mom or anything like that. It was some stranger. And that was all we writers had been asking of Big Pup. Give us a chance. Put us in the game. Let us play. Let the market decide. But it was so, and it still is, even harder, actually, to get a slot with Big Pub, which was kind of considered, you know, the national baseball franchise. You know, like, if you made it onto the team, it felt like you made it onto the Yankees. And so, you know, now Amazon was giving us this experience to actually reach out in the market to find some strange person and that they would read it. And then lo and behold, a review would come up. You know, and I think the first one I ever got was a 4-star book, and they loved it. And they said, well, you know, it needs a little bit of grammar help and everything like that, which of course it did, because, you know, I didn't have any editors or anything like that. But it was an honest, and they enjoyed themselves and they loved it. And then, I don't know how that book hit, but at the 4-month mark, it started selling about 15,000 copies a month. It was just rolling. And then, you know, Big Pub came in and they said, HarperCollins, there was a little bidding war, and HarperCollins emerged victorious atop the stack of publishing bodies, Conan style. And they bought my book, and they said, we want two sequels. So I dug in there and I wrote them, fully expecting, and now I have editing, now I have people to fix my grammar and things like that, fully expecting, you know, for the same amount of success to be repeated. And it just simply wasn't in the sequels. And they took the main book that was, I would say it was still rolling a year out, still just doing phenomenal sales, hanging out between the 200 or 400 mark. And I transferred it over to them, and it immediately died. And I've learned a lot of things about the algorithm since, and publishing and things like that. And I used to blame HarperCollins for a lot of it, but I realized now that that probably wasn't the problem. They had some, Big Pub has some marketing problems, and they definitely wanted Amazon to die. So, you know, the book died right there. No one bought the sequels, you know, in comparison to the amount that it sold. I mean, I would say, you know, The Old Man in the Wasteland has probably sold over 100,000 copies, and the other two books have never come anywhere near that. So that made no sense to me. Like, well, if these people, and it's overwhelmingly, The Old Man in the Wasteland is reviewed on Amazon and Goodreads, it's overwhelmingly positive. You know, people, I still get people saying, when are you going to write a sequel? And I'm like, I did write a sequel. So there were a lot of and eventually I had a falling out with HarperCollins, and I left because I really did want to leave, and I wanted to go back to indie because I saw the mistakes of TradePub, you know, and just the lack of, you know, service to the reader, a yearly release, the lack of respect for the writer, just a whole bunch of problems that were there. So I went back, and I thought, great, you know, I'll publish The Old Man in the Wasteland. And they're like, no, we own that. And so I had to wait about 2 years, and I had to spend some legal money and all that kind of stuff. But I eventually got the rights back, and then I had to I knew the audio, like, at that time, I have another series that's doing really well, Galaxy's Edge. And I knew from the numbers there that the audio was really doing well. And I had a relationship with a major narrator, and I can't say his name because this story is not good for him. But basically he backed out of the deal, for no good reason, and really kind of, well, let's just leave it at that. But, it's one of the problems with audio right now is that, you know, your book and your content rely on narrators, and narrators become the rock star of the and that's cool. But, you know, you have a business model and you're selling your books. And when it's in the narrator's hand, you need a certain amount of reliability. And I didn't get that from that narrator. And it was very sad because I think he would have been perfect for it. And so it fell to the B team, and I'm the B team, and I'm a, you know, very bad Shakespearean actor. And I did, you know, some Hollywood work and everything like that. But Hank has played Dungeons and Dragons with me, so he knows that I can do characters. So, I just Audible finally said, hey, Audible acquired it, the audio rights. And I knew I wanted to lead with the audio rights. So, I kind of put together a little, you know, production team on my own using a video game composer to help me with the recording and the editing and ultimately what would become the sound design for the bonus content. And then we spent a lot of time just getting this book, you know, pitch perfect. The feedback that I'm getting is that people really like it. They actually like hearing the narrator be the author. You know, if the author can come off the page and act it, which is very hard for authors, but, you know, I have some acting training, so I know how to do it. And so to answer your question, as you know me, I'm just a wordy son of a gun. You know, the Old Man in the Wasteland, which is the first book in the American Wasteland trilogy, which is now out on audio at Audible exclusively, is kind of a story of the entire indie movement. It's a story about like you could, and it's weird, like no one talks about the indie movement as a revolution, but people don't understand how revolutionary it was that we had a chance to take our content straight to the market instead of going through the tastemakers and the gatekeepers. And then what that looked like, what that, you know, like you and I both know, and we'll talk about people off mic, you know, people who were the cat's meow and now nothing's happening for them, or people who made it work and stayed on top, or it's just an interesting movement. And the Old Man in the Wasteland is very much like its journey to finally becoming an audiobook is very, you could use it as a typical example of the course of that revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the problem with revolutions, is that at some point they have to kind of evolve into systems.
Yeah.
And and that's not nearly as sexy as, you know, Viva la Revolution.
No.
But, you know, sitting in 2019, toward the end of 2019, here we are, and we're talking, you know, 8 or 9 years that this has had time to kind of blow up and then mature, and that untamed wild west of indie publishing has really settled into a big machinery in a lot of ways. Looking from this vantage point and having just taken this series that was so wildly successful in the beginning, you know, wrestling those rights back and now re-releasing the books and this brand new audio project that you've got, from that experience, looking back, where do you think we are in IndiePub now?
You know, we are now, we've moved now from, and it's great that you use the Wild West, because I think about that a lot. And it really was that sort of like prospector gold miner thing. We are right between the Wild West, where sort of the shovel salesmen come out instead of the gold miners, and they're selling you shovels, which is how you make a big fortune. And between the East Coast money, where people are, you know, like, and the East Coast money is now coming in, you know, like, you know, TradePub for all intents and purposes is dead. They're moving to a Cadillac clientele, but smart entrepreneurial groups and savvy sort of hybrid publishers are now dominating the market and beginning to take over. So you have like, I mean, I think like, it really was in 2011. It was just like a lot of like writers who hit it, you know, they wrote a vampire thing, or they were writing this thriller thing, or they're writing the apocalyptic thing. And then we just all kind of basically turned into Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood at the end, when we're, you know, like, you know, when we're drunk, you know, in a bowling alley, just in, you know, and it just like the tell, like I, you know, it's funny. I'll just still talk to people who are around, and they're like, 99% of the time, success ruined everybody. And it's sad and laughably funny, but now I'm seeing a whole new generation of really sort of young, savvy men and women coming in who approach it as a business and customer service. And so they identify a market and they begin to produce content in a consistent manner. I think a lot of us in IndiePub, we're trying to write what I call the lavender and croquet novel, like the very much Douglas Coupland or Less Than Zero guy, you know, like that. And now what it is people are just like, do you want to find out how Bigfoot fights people in space? You're like, I sure do. You know,
take my money,
Bigfoot space marine. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like the tastemakers, you know, will come and slam people rightly for doing that. But it's like reading is entertainment. Life is hard. The world is a little nuts right now. And I do think people are seeking escape, and especially in books. And the problem that TradePub is doing is that we're not going to get political or anything like that, but they're using this moment to teach people, and people are full up on teaching. And what they really want is they would like to know what Bigfoot Space Marine sounds like. Cause that sounds pretty interesting, you know, and like, it's just becoming like a fun time. And I think fun is becoming rare. And the people who are, you know, like Walt Disney was one of the savviest businessmen in the world. He monetized fun, you know, like he wasn't making Ford motor cars or, you know, anything like that. But he realized that, you know, like out of the depression, you know, he's a guy who delivered papers and everything like that. He realized that if people could watch a cartoon or escape the harsh realities of life for a minute, it made life a little better, and they were willing to give you money for that experience, even in tough times. And I think that's like, to answer your question, man, he's a wordy son of a gun. To answer your question, that's where we're at. We're at the Walt Disney moment when sort of these pioneering giants who figure it out have realized that you can monetize fun for people. And I would say the ones who are doing it right are the ones who have that Disney Walt Disney ethic towards it, which is to give the customer sort of that field of dreams moment, that taste, and like to over serve, you know, as opposed to just be, you know, rip people off or slam them and jam them or try to do a release every day or every week or whatever like that. People who are identifying their audience and as customer service providers, like just saying, you want Bigfoot Space Marine once a month? I'm going to do that. And I'm going to be honest and faithful about it. Then that's the stage that we're in. You know, eventually we will get to the big soulless East Coast money where, you know, these sort of like new hybrid publishers will sell to those people or become involved with those corporations. And then you'll get teams of 20 attempting to accomplish it. And my guess is that it will all come apart unless those people hire me or people like me to kind of oversee it. But you would have to pay me a lot of money to do that because I'm having so much fun right now. And then I probably still wouldn't do it.
You mentioned a little bit ago this other little series that you have that's wildly successful, the Galaxy's Edge series. Yes. That you write with our good friend Jason Ansbach. And you guys really, you know, again, pioneered a new sort of system for fan engagement and you know, kind of going all in because you guys fans are rabid and I was one of the very first fans. Thank you.
Super fan.
You know, it's super fan. But there's an interesting thing that happens, and it's been happening in IndiePub for quite a while, where people figure out the systems and they start cranking out content. Mm-hmm. And then they start being known for the systems that they create. Yes. And they become less known for the, you know, I'm not trying to sound, whatever, but for the art that they create. Right. You know, I don't know anybody that got into writing, to make gobs and gobs of money. I'm super excited and proud of the folks that have figured out how to do that. But that's rarely why people get in and get started. Can you talk a little bit about the balance between staying faithful to your original intent, and going back to that first love that we talked about earlier, and realizing that you're in a position where you are meeting audience demand and that customer service that you talked about from an artist's perspective? Right. Can you speak about balancing those two things so that you don't lose your soul in the process?
Yeah. It's with Galaxy's Edge, it is most summed up in the soul of and the person of Jason Ansbach, who is my co-creator in that and writing partner. And he just had such a deep love for a particular franchise we will name Star Wars and G.I. Joe. And he's just like so many people, you know. I think a lot of writers, there is a crowd that is now coming to it for money. And money alone. And I call it the quit your job crowd. But let's not get negative. But I think there's a lot of writers who will watch a Michael Bay movie and a giant, you know, mech destroying things. And they'll be like, I want to write that. I could write that. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right with it, because you have a story that you want to tell. And I think what allowed Galaxy's Edge to do what it did and reach a certain group of people, was that it was that group of people to begin with. It was a true believer in the sort of Star Wars, G.I. Joe, veterans, military science fiction, what, you know, we call male fiction, but we have a lot of female writers who like to read about those kind of males. We just started there because we loved there. What I see people doing now, and everybody can say Nick Cole is an evil, awful person, but this is what I do. I tell you the truth, and some of you don't like it. But there are people that identify a popular genre where they think money is being made. You know, 6 months to a year ago, it was harem. And with no sort of interest in that or love for it, or, you know, Jason's sort of like, the more I know Jason, I don't think he ever fully revealed to me how much he loved Star Wars, but he'll say things now. And I'm like, whoa, you were Kurtz upriver with that. You know, like, he just knew everything about it. He loved it. He lived the world. He bought everything, you know, like, and Star Wars could have had all of these people, but they treated them like, you know, crap, as we all know. And what Jason and I did is we said, hey, we'll treat you great. You know, we won't do those things to you. And we'll tell that those type of stories in stone and tone and style and feel and look. But the main thing that we came to is we became the gorillas. You know, Jason was already a gorilla. I had to put on a gorilla suit. I love Star Wars too. I have other gifts that I bring to it. You know, I'm destructive and interesting and all those kind of things. But I love Star Wars too. And what I was able to do with Jason is draft on his love of Star Wars and his love of G.I. Joe and his love of military science fiction. So the short answer is we loved it from the beginning, and we are the readers. We would read this if we weren't writing it. And so that's the first thing. And so whenever anybody comes along and they hear like Lit RPG is great, and I'm not saying Lit RPG is bad, but you should love Lit RPG. You should love reading it. It's not maybe just you love playing games, but I think what I see so many people doing now is they attend a conference and someone says, here are the 7 steps that I did, and then I quit my job. Systems, like you were saying. And that is not good. And people think, yeah, but having money is good. I'm like, you're right. It is an honorable thing to have a profession and take care of your family. But what happens if the worst possible thing happens to you? And you go, what? What's the worst possible thing? I don't publish? No. The worst possible thing that can happen to you is you actually have success in something you don't love. You're like, well, I got money. Yeah, you got money. But now you're on the back of the tiger. And if you get off the tiger, you lose the money. So now you got to create content and something that's not your métier, not something that you don't enjoy. And so what I would say to everybody when I see them writing books or whatever it is, you know, prepare for success by loving and being a fan, or whatever you want to call it, of the thing that you love. And I always say to myself, I always ask myself, would you write this if you were in prison for murder right now? I don't know why I add the murder part. I'm strange. But like, if I was in prison, you know, trying to avoid shower rape and getting knifed and everything like that, I'd write stuff. And I ask myself, you're not getting it published. You know, it's probably, you don't get any email or anything like that. What would you write just to satisfy your soul? So you know, there's that prison murder moment that we all have to ask ourselves. You know, I bet you never thought that was coming on this podcast. You know, if you were in prison for life and you were only writing for yourself, what would you write? And that's a key to not becoming a weekly, monthly release, you know, genre chasing hack system person. And that may sound harsh and critical of people, and I don't mean to, but I'm just saying you are setting yourself up for a lot of heartache and stress if you go down that road, because you'll meet a lot of people who will knife you in the back just for rankings. And you know, writing is a wonderfully lovely business, and you know it well. I mean, Hank, it can be so satisfying, and especially the interactions, but it can get really negative and ugly, and people can be nasty to each other. And so you can't let that stuff get in your way. And the fun thing about Galaxy's Edge is, you know, we've had our moment, Jason and I have had our moments of disagreement, and then we've had struggles within, you know, the genre. We've had times when something technically happened and dropped the ball. You know, you have problems, and the more success you have, the more problems you have. But it's never been a problem to come back and write about Tyrus Rex, this, you know, sort of revenge space mercenary, Boba Fett, bounty hunter and everything like that, because you're like, oh, now I'm back in my ship and I, you know, I'm flying in hyperspace and, oh, no, he's got to do this thing. And you're like, I'm playing in the dirt. And that's how Jason and I always call it. Like, we call writing playing with action figures in the dirt, and we've just given ourselves license to be 12 again. And so the only clue that I can give everybody is, like, try to find that thing. Even if it's not successful, if you really understand how big Amazon is, you can write anything. And if you write it truthfully and you love what you're doing, then when the success comes, it won't be – you won't feel like you're slitting a vein to have to do it, which is – imagine the pressure of, like – because if you get money and you get success, you start acquiring more debt and possessions and people. And then suddenly these people are looking at you like, hey, why aren't you writing another Space Marine Bigfoot story? And you're like, I only got into Space Marine Bigfoot because it was hot. Now I hate Bigfoot, you know.
And you've left one day job for one that you created, yeah, which you equally, yeah, hate. And you have no one to blame but, yeah, yourself.
And the stories of writers who ended up hating their main characters are legion. You know, don't become that, yeah, person.
Yeah. Man, so many cautionary tales out there.
My wife is one of the cautionary tales.
Oh, mine and yours both.
About the drinking.
I think we actually talked about drinking in our very first episode, but yeah. Anyway, well, let's come back around to American Wasteland. You produced with the team that you put together the complete Wasteland Saga audiobook. And like you talked about earlier, you know, we love to hear authors read their work. Some people don't pull it off very well. Looking at you, yeah, Stephen King. I've always thought that was very strange, because who would be able to interpret the work better than the person that wrote it? And I love when an author can do that and can get the, I think it comes down to just confidence of, you know, being able to put their true intentions out, I guess is what it comes down to. I don't know. But you were the perfect person to narrate this. What were your fears and trepidations, if you had any, going in? And were you excited that people would read this book, would hear this book the way you fully intended?
Right. You know, going back to the audiobook narrator that originally I had intended, and we had not a falling out, but it just, you know, I couldn't rely on him. He is a great narrator. I mean, like, that's why I wanted him, and everybody knows this person is great. And he hasn't read the books or anything, but he makes things come alive for people, and people don't understand how great that skill is and how great this person is. And like, it's tough. And so I love Stephen King, and I do. There is a sweetness when he reads his own books, but he can't act his own books. It's weird, you know, and that's probably the norm. But if you have a performance background, then you might be able to try. And so there were things that I discovered in the process. I think ultimately I'll just say it really was a gift from God for me to be able to narrate it, because what I had forgotten about The Old Man and the Wasteland is that a lot of the dialogue is internal dialogue, and it's with an imaginary character. It's with the character, long story short, in The Old Man and the Wasteland, the main character is a salvager who lives out in the desert. And for 40 years, he's only had one book to read because the world got burned up. And that book is The Old Man and the Sea. And he has read that book so much that the main character of that story, who most people don't know, his name is Santiago, has become real to him. And so when he's out in the wasteland, when he's in trouble, when he's trying to solve a problem, when he's running from wolves or savages or whatever, Santiago is right there talking to him. You know, like, he's lonely, and this, his friend has become real. And so I don't know, when I would read through it, I knew what Santiago's dialogue was. And a lot of people who've read the book say it's a very comforting, meditative book. Like, it's very kind of zenned out. And I don't know that a narrator would have picked that up. I think the great ones would have, like the guy that I wanted to read it. And, but I knew where to go. I knew what to do. Yeah. And I knew that Santiago's voice, you know, kind of for me was the most interesting man in the world kind of voice. And he would say, "Yes, my friend, but you don't know what you're going to do," you know, like that kind of stuff. And then I had to get into some other characters. You know, the old man eventually acquires some people to help him and things like that. But I think whenever I get really stressed out or anything like that, I'll get an ocular migraine. And even though if I don't know it, and so the first day of recording, I go in and like we start recording and it appears. And I was like, "Oh, you must be a little stressed out about this." So it's kind of like it's fun and interesting. And so much so that like Audible's asked me now to narrate more books, and I'm into it. You know, it's kind of fun. And I even have some more projects that I'm going to narrate. But it's really neat. But as a writer, no one knows it better than you do. The testament of the great narrators that we have coming online is that they can get in there and do it and make it come alive for people. And it's pretty cool. Like, it's always hard when you write your book and you listen to somebody else and they go, "Oh, they didn't pronounce that right," or, "Oh, that's not," like we had that in Galaxy's Edge. One of the characters that R.C. Bray did wasn't how we heard him. But then how R.C. Bray did him was how we began to hear him. And that's how we began to write it, because people love that character because he's a great narrator. So, you know, like it's fun. Like there's so many fun things coming about in audiobooks, and audiobooks are the new paradigm shift. It's where most of our money is coming from. But there are some, like I said, there are some problems. You can get left high and dry by a narrator for a number of reasons. You have to manage the audience, the crossover, things like that. You have to think, you know, if you recruit a narrator who's really big in the romance world and you're writing Bigfoot Space Marine, you are probably going to get a lot of women coming over from that, because what you find with narrators is that a lot of listeners follow the voice. They don't necessarily follow the genre. And so that could hurt you, you know, could help, could hurt you. You have to weigh all those things out. But you know, you're a theater person and I'm a theater person. And that's what I love most about audiobooks is getting to do theater, getting to really chew. Like I never did in my acting career. If you ever seen me in real life, you would say, "Wow, is that Brad Pitt?" But it's not. I never got recruited, you know, to do leads. I'm not a handsome person, but I'm kind of a rugged or roguish looking kind of person, a thug. I would get a lot of villains and everything like that. And so I learned how to play villains. And the way that you learn how to play villains is one note. You're just broad, you're big, you're scene chewy, you don't have a lot of arc. You do a lot of character stuff. And that's ultimately what I like doing. When you're playing the lead, you generally have to be less is more, and you have to evolve, and you have to do all this, you know, bull stuff, like, you know, kiss. And, you know, when you're a villain, you get to, like, when I played the Duke of Cornwall in King Lear, I got to have a sword fight. I got to gouge out a guy's eyes. I got to stab a guy in the back. You know, I got to rant and rave and pound my chest. Like, that's the stuff I like.
And just chew scenery the whole way.
And in audiobooks, like, yeah, you play the lead, but you also get to play all the lunatics. And that's the part I like, you know. Oh, and there's one last thing. you start crying in your own books. Cause there's like, you know, I mean, like you and I are men's men. We, you know, you are a Southerner. I am a Southerner by default. We are men's men, but I know you cry when you read your books. Like there's moments where you cry, you know?
Yeah.
And I do too. And so now you're crying on in front of the mic, and you kind of use it, you know, and there was about in the one big scene at the end of the first book, it took about 20 takes and my sound engineer was just dying laughing. And he's all, "You are crying." I'm like, "I can't stop it."
I love it.
That was like, you know, and then, you know, there's a book called Tuesdays with Maury where, his big fear is that someone is going to have to, clean him up after he uses the restroom because he's losing his bodily functions. And he knows through the entire thing, he keeps talking about it. He's like, you know, this is my big fear. Not being able to take care of myself, having to use the restroom and having somebody have to do that. And I guess I would say for me, crying in those moments was what I was dreading in reading the audiobook. It was, you know, the same Tuesdays with Maury moment, except not with death or defecation. And then it happened, and just like in Tuesdays with Maury, he says, it finally happened, and my person helped me, and we just laughed about it and got through it, and it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And that was the same thing of like, real, because villains don't do high drama. We don't cry. We gasp. We curse. You know, we so foiled again, but we never like break down and cry. You don't have that moment. And so for me, like to have to do that in the book, I did it and I was worried about it. And then I did it and I was like, okay, it wasn't that bad. It was actually quite pleasing and enjoyable. And, you know, then I look over and my wife is sobbing. And then the engineer, I get payback because he's editing it one night. And I go over the next morning to do production. And he looks at me and goes, you know that part where he has to say goodbye to his granddaughter? And he goes, I was editing that about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said, so I stopped and went into my daughter's room and just put my hand on her to make sure she was okay. And I'm like, gotcha.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Oh, that's amazing. You know, another thing you don't think about is, you know, as writers, you could have a really productive day and get out 5,000 words, sometimes maybe a 7,000 word day. And, you know, we thump our chest and like, look what I did today. This is amazing. Cause you know, most people have about a 1,500 to 2,000 word day and, you know, consider that successful. And that's about 20. If you got 5,000 words, it's about 20 pages, you know, of text that you got out. And that's wonderful. If you're a narrator reading 20 pages and not just reading them, but emoting through that and acting out characters and all that is exhausting. It's a whole different skill set on the other end,
yeah,
isn't it?
So I knew I was going to, I don't like the sound of my voice like everybody in the entire world. So, you know, we're all in the same boat. And I wish I had that sort of smoke and dry leaves voice like Alec Baldwin, but I don't. I have a nice sort of resonant baritone where I wish I had a little more bass in it. We're all kind of like that. So I actually do vocal exercises from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England. So, you know, all the Ian McKellen stuff. And that helps. But even having done that every morning and just making sure my voice was ready to move, movement of the voice is a very big thing. You can look on my Facebook page or YouTube channel. I post the workout that I do with my voice. And that takes about 20 minutes to get ready. I really wish I had there's another vocal technique I learned when I was, acting called the I can never remember it, but it's this nice lady and everybody, like all the serious acting people, they kind of get into that. It's kind of like a cult, like some book systems and, book launch systems. But even having done all that, I was recording what you get in American Wasteland, which is the book that we're talking about. You actually get 3 books and some bonus content. And so that turned out to be about 21 hours. And it actually takes about 2 hours to record 1 hour. When you're really rolling, when when you're in the zone, everything like that. At first day of production, you're lucky to get through 4 chapters. Like by the last day, you're banging out like 10 to 12 chapters. There's probably a high point where you like do 16 chapters and break your voice. But at the end of the day, you're smoked. You're done. And what I did through this character, because there was a lot of scene chewing towards the end, the middle and the end are really kind of lunatic, because there's a lot of, like, you know, if you watched Mad Max, there's a lot of those kind of people. I strained my vocal cords, and, like, it's not like you're having a heart attack, but you're like saying, I bet this is what a heart attack feels like, you know, just like your chest is always tight and like you can't swallow. And just like, I got some, you know, it's just the voice. We don't use our voice as much as we think we do. And so when you go in and you speak for like 8 hours and you're in a dark booth staring at a screen, it gets rough, you know, and you realize, oh, my eyes aren't as great as I thought they were. And, you know, you have an engineer saying, oh, let's do that take again. And you have a producer who was Nicole on this, who's saying, who's following along on the text. And they're like, you drop this word. And you can get like a little like, oh, don't tell me, I'm the writer, you know, but like, I even got an email from Audible this morning. They're like, oh, you left a line out of the book. And I'm like, well, I actually did that on purpose because I hated that line. And I don't know why. Yeah. You know, and they're like, well, we'd like that line back in. I'm like, okay. You know, so it's a super exhausting practice. And when you're the writer, you're like, you know, we were talking about word count. We then say, well, I got to do my 2,000 to 5,000 words a day because, you know, I have to be a customer service provider to the people in Galaxy's Edge and the other franchises that I'm working on, or other stories that I'm working on, or things that I've obligated myself to. And if you've just, you know, narrated for 6 to 8 hours, spoiler, you don't feel like writing. You feel like playing Call of Duty.
Yeah.
So, if I go forward on some new projects I'm doing, I think what I'm going to do is do my recording at night after because the writing, as a writer, you have to remember that you have a primary job, just like in the military. Everybody works the rifle. And as a writer, your job is to produce content. And that's my main job. So, you know, the narrating is fun. I enjoy it. I'd like to make more out of it. And I hope people enjoy this. And the best way to get me to do more is to buy American Wasteland on Audible right now. But my main job is to either write Galaxy's Edge. People want weird novels. People want Soda Pop Soldier novels. I have some fantasy projects I'm working on, some other different genres I'm developing. My job is to work the rifle. My job is to work the keyboard. That's my job.
I know that that you and Jason have this entire universe and you have a plan that you guys are really working and have set up reader expectation that, you know, things are coming out at certain times and have really kind of settled into a nice groove there. But before Galaxy's Edge, like, you were writing lots of different things on your own. After revisiting The Wasteland and narrating and, you know, heading up the re-release of, you know, the ebooks and the audiobook and all that, does that light a bit of a fire under you for more solo projects?
I have to keep Galaxy's Edge the main thing because of the contract that we have with the readers, which was never to do what was done to them by the mouse. And those people are paying the bills right now. And they're wonderful people. And I love them, and they've become my friends. They've even become more than my friends. There are many of them who've become my heroes because of their time in Afghanistan or Iraq and the things that they share with us. So I got to keep doing that because that's my mission in life until I get a new mission. But always, because I think every writer has this, you know, like, sometimes we'll read a detective story and we're like, I could do that. You know, and you're like, yeah, but you don't write detective stories. You write time novels, you know, or you write Space Marine. And that's the death of every writer is, you know, like, you know, I just saw where a major thriller author just signed a 7-figure deal for a fantasy series. And I'm like, well, that won't work out. Because I've done that, because I've just jumped around and do it. Like, my brand is just now Nick Cole. You know, like, it's just that, yeah, I have to own that. I write a lot of weird stuff. You can probably figure out what I write by the way that I write it. I don't think that's a good thing for most writers. I think you should write a brand, and you should, like I was saying, that whole thing about you should love this and stick with that because that's where your bread and butter is. When you start jumping around, you start losing people. You know, like people who you thought were reading you, no, they were really reading Bigfoot Space Marine. And now that you're doing, vampire detective, they're not going to follow you. Some will, but the majority, it's always strange when most don't. It's always strange when the weird readers say, I don't like Galaxy's Edge. Or when, you know, the Galaxy's Edge people say, I don't like Soda Pop Soldier. And you're like, yeah, but it's me. And they're like, we don't care about you. And that's the most wonderful thing. It's the trap that like we were talking about, all the people that became successes, the trap that they fell into. And it's very easy to do when you read the Amazon reviews or when people write you letters and things like that, is to think that it's all about you. But it really isn't. It's about your characters and the things that you're writing. And they really like, there are actually people that think Cole Anspach is one person. And I'm happy with that. That's great. You know, like, that's fine. But I do, like you, have this need to write other things. And so, I want to write 57 Tyrus Rex novels. I want to finish seasons 2 and 3 of Galaxy's Edge. We have some other little things that we're developing too. I want the Galaxy's Edge. I want to, you know, write the Galaxy's Edge series until I die, or until they, you know, kick it, until they chip us off the ice floe and float us away like the Eskimos do with their elderly. Maybe they don't do that anymore, but it's always nice to think that they do that.
Right. Just like thinking if you're in prison for murder.
Exactly. That's how my mind works. Same. But at the same time, both Jason and I carve out secret time for other projects. So Jason has some other projects he's working on. I have some projects I'm working on. And I think that's important because it's a conversation I have with Jason. Like, you need to have your brand. You need to build your brand. Galaxy's Edge is great, all that kind of stuff. But I was always worried that Disney would sue us into oblivion, even though we were first and owned the name. But what happened is Disney got afraid of us and said, you can do what you want, just don't bother us, because we were first. But I don't trust big corporations. I'm still waiting to kind of get smote and say, oh, you can't do Galaxy's Edge now. Oh, well, we could rebrand it, but I've been down that path. It won't be as successful. Like, we owned that title. So I always tell Jason, you know, make sure you're working on your other stuff, you know, build something. And I'm doing the same thing too. So yeah, I've got some new fun things I'm working on.
Well, I love that you guys, that the Galaxy's Edge is moving forward and with a strong purpose. That makes me so happy. But American Wasteland out, available now and from Audible. There's a link to it in the show notes, as well as the full trilogy and ebooks and paperbacks. Nick, always fun to catch up. Tell people where they can find you online to plug in with all the great stuff that you do.
I would say just the best thing that you could do is head over to nickcoldbooks.com, and you can kind of find me there through the various social media things. If you go on Facebook, just, you know, find Nick Cole author, you know, go with the author page. You'll like that. I just, you know, post, you know, stuff about science fiction and occasionally my books. And, you know, it's just more of like, if you're a reader, that's what you love. You're welcome to follow me, like, personally. I have political opinions and things like that, and that might be a turnoff to some people, but I generally try to keep that distant in my writing and just give people a good time no matter what. Not saying it doesn't sneak in, but I am cognizant in this day and age that people are just sick to death of being, you know, lectured, and that they really are just looking for Bigfoot Space Marine to throw a couple of fraggers into the airlock and, you know, clear it with his axe, his space axe, his space laser axe.
Space laser axe. Well, we'll link up all of it in the show notes. Nick, thank you so much, brother, for coming on and for being my friend. Thanks for joining me on this journey all these years.
Thank you, sir. I love you.
I love you too, brother.